Hi, this is Patti LuPone.
This is Allison Janney.
This is Matt Ballmer.
This is Donna Murphy.
This is Nia Vardalos.
This is Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
This is Beanie Feldstein.
I'm Octavia Spencer.
This is Ben Platt, and you're listening to Little Known Facts with my favorite person on the planet, Alana Levine.
A-OK.
Welcome to Little Known Facts, a podcast where you will hear unfiltered, raw, honest, and uniquely funny interviews with artists you love as they talk about the art they love to make. I'm your host, Ilana Levine.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, I heard you need an inspiration. Here's Alana and friends with some revelations. Little known back to the day. Every little thing's gonna be A-OK.
Little known fact about my guest today, he and his longtime collaborator Duncan Sheik met because they were both Buddhists who wanted to chant together, and from that original meeting came Spring Awakening and so many other artistic projects. And then Stephen Sader, who is my brilliant guest today, has just written so many beautiful pieces of art, poetry, novels, plays, screenplays, teleplays, and musicals. And I am so grateful to have had this time with him today. And I also really encourage you to listen to his most recent project, an album he collaborated on with the great Burt Bacharach. Welcome Stephen Sader to the podcast.
A-OK.
Everyone, my guest today is Stephen Sader. Stephen is a Tony, Grammy, and Olivier Award-winning lyricist, librettist, author, poet, screenwriter. He and Duncan Sheik wrote the musical Spring Awakening. He and Duncan, along with Jesse Nelson, also wrote the musical Alice by Heart. Most recently, he and the great Burt Bacharach partnered to create the concept album Some Lovers with a cast of star-studded, gorgeous Broadway voices. I think I know Stephen more than any of my 200 and something previous guests because of our early lives in the theater together, running around New York, babies that we were. Stephen Sader, welcome to Little Known Facts, my friend.
Alana, it's so amazing to see you and to reel through time thinking about working on us. It was Asylum. Do you remember?
Yes.
It was Asylum. It was at Naked Angels, and it was Michael Mayer, who of course went on to direct Spring Awakening.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. And I really love thinking about that time because, well, when I think about you, I think, God, the hunger, ambition, talent, creativity, and generosity of spirit that you brought into that room in the 90s is still the way you walk into every work relationship that you enter. Everyone I know, and I know 1 million people who have been in your things or directed your things, and what everyone comes away saying is that they felt like they did their best work because you gave them permission to show up and do their best work. And that is not a small thing.
That's one of the most remarkable things anyone's ever said to me. I mean, professionally, you know what I mean? About my professional life. You know what? So what it brings up on me is how remarkable this pandemic has been for me in terms of the work I've done with new directors, directors whom I'd never met, younger directors, young career directors. And I have multiple projects with people whom I now like love and depend on, whom I've never met in person, who have these virtual relationships to where we become close. Teddy Bergman, do you know Teddy Bergman? He's directing, we're working together on Murder at the Gates, Sai Alakon. These are younger directors coming and are working on The Nightingale with Duncan. Well, there are And there are multiple projects I could talk about, because like when I'm working on, you know, Our Lady Jay and our workouts, but she and I have now met and become good friends, and we're working on a new musical with Duncan. But so much has, I guess, because we stayed in.
And also revisiting Spring Awakening in this benefit concert. So for you to have that kind of reunion amidst this deeply painful, troubling, scary time, so much beautiful art was brought forth. It's funny that you talk about sort of all of these relationships with new directors that you've had. There's a strange intimacy. You know, I had been on an occasional Zoom call, maybe Skype, in my life. You know, I've had to audition with directors who weren't in the country. I mean, there were ways in which technology was available to us, but it is so incredible to me that virtually we have continued to be able to make work. And you have really done that. I mean, I don't know. We'll talk about some Lovers, which is maybe your newest, the newest baby you've given birth to publicly. It sounds like you have a lot going on behind the scenes for us to all look forward to. I think as we speak, Spring Awakening is at the Alameda in London. Have they been able to remain performing?
And I want to say, actually, that maybe the best example I could give of what we're talking about was my work with Rupert Gould, who's in London. And we worked on Spring Awakening. We also have a film project we're working on together. But I was throughout, from the beginning of lockdown, when New York and London were the epicenters of this pandemic, we were Zooming daily. And as you say, I had actually Skyped a fair amount, but Zoom I had rarely ever been on. And it became this regular part of my day. And now we have this production. Those are the two things. I lived like in such an isolated way in my apartment. Because, you know, I've had a coastal life for years, going back to New York, LA. Here, I was by myself with my books, really focused, really working. And then I came out for the two most extraordinary events, the reunion concert. It was a once in a lifetime event for all of us. We can talk about it. It was so unbelievably emotional. And then to go from that 3 days later to London to see this it's such a reinvention what Rupert's done. And I was part of it with him. I was in my hotel in London writing new lyrics and revising scenes of Spring Awakening. It was crazy.
So you have revisited that text and that show.
Yeah.
Were there things that you had always, I mean, there have been many productions all over the world and revivals and Deaf West. I mean, it has been reinvented and reimagined by so many beautiful artists. Was there always something? I mean, I remember Michael Mayer, our beloved Michael, calling me and saying, I'm working on this thing at the Atlantic Theater Company. Will you come early? I think it's fantastic. I want eyes because I think I'm doing something I've never done before. And I remember going in and going, yes, in fact, this is something actually no one's ever done before. And I have not one note except, can I come every night and see it for the rest of my life and still listen to it every day? And now my kids listen to it. And there's something about like that one musical and the number of times I've used it in preparation for my own performance. But I'm curious when you were able to sit with Rupert and work on it again, has there always been something you wanted to rework, or was it based on what's going on in the world today?
It was the latter. Okay. The production in London right now, people there were calling it a bespoke production. They call about bespoke when something is hand-tailored for someone, like they designed a shirt for you. It's a tailoring term. And I don't think I would incorporate these changes in future productions, but they were for this moment we're in and for Rupert's vision of the piece and for the work he and I had done together. And they were not things. Spring Awakening is finished. You know, it's complete. However, we replaced the opening song of Act Two with a song from Off Broadway, which had never been heard, which probably you heard at the Atlantic, which never been heard in the UK.
Yeah.
We added two reprises. I did work on scenes to kind of bring the young women up to date a bit, to give Bedlam more agency, and also to bring it into this moment of youth activism. And the, you know, for the entire cast who are young, it was their first show since the pandemic struck. And for many of them, it was their first production, professional production. So it was so remarkable to be with them. Rupert's really turned Totally Fucked into an anthem of, someone was calling it in The Guardian, like the COVID generation, you know, the COVID, because I mean, how bad has this been? It's been terrible for all of us, but for young people,
yeah,
you have them in your house, so you
know.
I mean, it's just been so agonizing.
Yeah.
And to see those kids released and out on stage. So it was really for that. However, I'm going now to say, to get to the end of your question, I just wrote an email, which I have held back sending him. There are two little things in Spring Awakening that I had never changed. They're tiny. One is a tiny line. One is a tiny lyric. And I was about to say to Rupert, if we should have the fortune that our show has a future life, what about these ideas? You know, I had made changes when we opened the show in London back in the day, whatever year that was. Let's say it was 2010.
Yeah.
And around there. And Michael was there. Michael directed it. And I implemented changes to the show, which I wanted to do, which, in fact, I said to him, and which were we then incorporated in the national tour and then belatedly incorporated into the Broadway production, and which are part of what's licensed. And I said to Michael, do we want to incorporate these into the concert? And he said, no, we should do exactly what we did.
Well, I have two themes, I guess, I want to talk to you about. One is, I think so much about, you know, for anyone who has followed you, not just as an artist, but as a human, they know that a lot of your life was spent in isolation due to either illness as a young person or something that could have been tragic in terms of we might have lost you, but your apartment was on fire, you jumped, and you had to heal in isolation for a very long time. These are just parts of your biography, poorly written on Wikipedia, beautifully written in articles with real journalists, right? So you are someone unlike most of us when you describe this moment, or you know, Totally Fucked is an anthem for young people at this moment. You have been so inside a time in your life, chapters of your life, of great isolation and quarantine. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit what it has been like as someone who has personally experienced it, watching communities globally dealing with something you were forced to deal with at a very early age and then later in your young adult life.
Oh, that is such a remarkable question. Well, first, I would say that for me, I had had an apprenticeship in isolation. Mm-hmm. As you said, I had spent so much time in it that I was able to just be in gear, to focus, to write. We all have so many friends who performers and directors and producers who couldn't do their work. But I also have a lot of writer friends, some of whom thrived, but some of whom really needed the human interaction or were just blocked or were in a dark place, or I was able to just focus. But I did write a kind of poetically ambitious, this longer poem I've wanted to write, which was roused by the feelings you're talking about, which was around the globe seeing communities of isolated individuals and death-struck individuals. And illness struck individuals and whole nations that were so under siege, and governments in denial. So I don't know that I brought my, I suppose you're right. I guess that's part of why it's such a remarkable question to me, is that it illuminates part of myself, that maybe that was how I was able to enter into those feelings empathetically, is that I had experienced it myself. I didn't think of it that way at all.
Right.
It's been devastating, of course. And we know so many people. My aunt and uncle were taken. I don't want to begin for myself, but there are so many people. We've all lost so many people, and the theater community has been devastated.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many lanes we could travel on right now, but you think back to the AIDS epidemic, where that was an epidemic that ravaged so many communities, but really particularly the theater community. Yeah. And so it has awakened a lot of memories of a time of loss and an incredible pride I feel in our community for the ways in which we rally together and love and heal and find ways to persevere and raise money and, you know, boots on the ground and emotionally to help heal. I want to talk a lot about, you know, when you mention all these new people that you're working with, and I can only imagine how unbelievably thrilling it would be to be a young director and to be mentored and in collaboration with you. And I love how much you love doing that and meeting these new creatives. But you have also been repeat offender, sounds like a negative, but you and Duncan have been repeat offenders in terms of bringing work into the world. And Jesse Nelson, who I know you do a lot of, you know, non-theater projects with as well, since, you know, movie stuff and TV stuff. Can you take us back to how did you and Duncan originally meet and what it is that keeps you coming back for more with each other collaboratively?
Yeah, you know, I just was at his house and I hadn't been. He has a new place he's living. It's a townhouse.
And a new child.
A child. And I was there with his daughter, whom I hadn't seen in a while. Mm-hmm. Almost since she was a newborn.
You know, this pandemic.
I wasn't going to go over to be with their child when, you know, I don't want to bring something into the house. So I thought, wow, we have seen each other so many stages of our lives. We met because we're both Buddhists, because we both chant. And we met in 1999 because we chanted together at his apartment, and we had there was no ulterior motive. We were just chanting, and he wanted to talk. I was had responsibility in the arts division of the sort of world peace grassroots organization. We're part of the Soka Gakkai International. And he was talking about his career roles and artistic role. You know, we were just talking, and that it was like a meeting of a lifetime. And we ended up, I left that night, late. And as I was leaving, I was working on something in London with Laurie Anderson, which he thought was very cool. And I was also working on a show down at here, a showcase. And he said, as I was leaving, he said, is there a song in the show? And I said, oh, there's just this song that I wrote and it's nothing. And he said, is there a lyric I could see? And I went home and faxed it to him. And the next day, as I was leaving to London, he called me and we met for lunch. He said, meet me for lunch. And he gave me a CD of this song, and it was so beautiful. And I came back from London. It was Rob Sedgwick. Did you know Rob Sedgwick?
Yeah.
Was playing the lead in the show.
Yes. And he said, we were in acting class together.
Well, there you are.
Yes.
So he said to me, we've got this amazing Dylan song we've got to use for the show. And I said, I wrote a song with Duncan Sheik. And he said, oh, but we need an up-tempo song. And I said, well, maybe I could write an up-tempo lyric, having never aspired to write lyrics. And Duncan had never written songs with anyone else or thought about it. And so I faxed him another, I remember he was at Sundance, I faxed him another lyric and he said it. And then we did a couple of these and he proposed we do an album together. This is within like a month or so of knowing each other. And then he came to see the show here and he loved the show. We had our two songs in it and I said, we should create a piece of theater together. And he said, he made a face and said, musical theater. I said, well, we could do something cool. And he said, I want the music to be relevant to the culture at large. And the minute he said it, I thought of Spring Awakening.
Was that a piece of literature that had always meant something to you, or did it just pop into your head?
This is a little known fact that my audition piece when I moved to New York from Princeton was Hanschen's monologue from Spring Awakening. So I'd known the play. I grew up in Evansville, Indiana, and I would go to the, I was sick a lot as a kid and I hardly went to school, and I went to the library And I found this book that was so sexy and racy and kind of forbidden, Spring Awakening. So I had known about the play since, I don't know when, like seventh grade. And I had loved the play. It was a treasured illicit text. And I don't know, it just came to me. It seemed that the play was so full of these arias of longing, of young people yearning and anguished and aspiring. And I thought that the place that young people have found release from an expression of those cries for generations has been rock music. So it seemed like a good fit.
And forgive my naivete, because I don't know things that are like copyrighted and not copyrighted. Mm-hmm. So now you're these two young artists who are like, okay, let's agree, we'll do Spring Awakening. Okay. So then what happens? Like, do you have to get the rights? Do you go to Atlantic? Does that happen later?
No, it was in public domain.
Okay. It's old enough. Okay.
Everything so I've done, except this thing I'm now working on with Duncan and Our Lady J, which is based on a movie.
Okay.
It's a great musical we're working on. Everything else has been in public domain. The Nightingale,
Got it. So you're not jumping through hoops and agents for that, and you're free to do what you want to do.
Yes.
And so in the early days, are you sitting at a table together facing each other with your computers, you know, across from each other, or are you writing scenes and sending him pages? You mentioned the word fax earlier for our young people at home. Google it. What was the like, how does it go from ding, Spring Awakening, to the beginning of a creative process with a new partner?
The first thing was, he had reservations about musical theater, and he said,
did he even like theater? Did he go see theater? Did he know theater?
But he liked Pinter. Mm-hmm. He had seen, when he was like very young, Sweeney Todd.
Where's Duncan from? Where did he grow up?
He was born in New Jersey, but he grew up in South Carolina.
Okay.
Hilton Head.
Okay.
But he, I mean, Duncan is a very literate and articulate guy, and Brown grad. And so he went to theater in that respect, but he was not someone who was clocking in musicals.
Okay.
Involved in that world. So he said he'd hated in musicals when people talked and then they sang and then they talked and it felt arbitrary why they were talking and why they were singing. And I had this idea. I remember calling him. I was standing on 72nd Street. We did have cell phones of a kind then. And they were huge. And
yeah. Then I said to suitcase him, phone.
I said, what if the songs function as interior monologues? So we went into the hearts and like Shakespearean soliloquies. I remember we had this whole talk about it. And he liked that idea. And so I began adapting the play, translating the play from German, and writing lyrics. And I would fax him lyrics. And we, to this day, have a process where we don't work together in the same room.
Okay.
And we've been at a lot of retreats together, or workshop, you know, you're all out of town together, so we're in the same hotel, and we can be in the same, we've rented houses together, you know, and at New York Stage and Film, and like, I can be in one room working, and he's in another. It's not like we avoid each other. But we both have solitary processes. Whereas, for example, and I know we're talking about Duncan, when I work with Burt Bacharach,
yeah,
I hand him a physical copy of the lyric. He calls when he has something, you come by. I come back to his house. He's written bars of music across the handwritten, the copy I've, not the handwritten, the typed, you know, the printed page I've given him. He's handwritten bars of music. And you sit at the piano and you go through it. And you're sitting next to Burt Bacharach. So you are losing your mind.
You're already losing your mind. Exactly.
Yeah, he's turning your words into a Bacharach song. And
he's
doing it verbatim. Like, the first songs were completely verbatim. And then he said what I had given him to music verbatim. And then he'll set the verse. And he'll say, I hear this kind of thing. And then he starts singing this do-do-do to you. And then you pulls out this cassette deck, like Sam Goody or wherever they sold these things. and I've gotten adept at it, like using this cassette deck. So we tape the different takes of, so I have all these cassettes of Bert singing to me. And then I bring it home and turn it into digital information and listen to it and write lyrics to that part and then integrate them into the whole. And then I bring that lyric back to his house.
So you take the doobie doobie doo, make he goes doobie doobie doo as he plunks out the Bert's not plunking, but he's creating music on his piano. You take the doobie doobie doo, make it words.
Yes.
From the English language, go back and that's the album, Some Lovers.
No. There's been, I mean, in the song, yes. I mean, it's not, it wasn't that fast. But there's like verses or chorus that are just as I wrote them. And then they're the doobie-doobie-doo words.
Yes.
And then maybe because of the doobie-doo words, you want to revisit what you'd written as the chorus. Or there's the second chorus. Or there's a bridge. And you go back and forth to his house and sitting at the piano. It's a whole old-fashioned, great process where you're writing. There's a Christmas song that concludes the Some Lovers album, and we wrote it in that old-fashioned grill-building way in the heat of July, standing in his, and he said to me at one point, he kept revising the bridge, and I have to say 100 times, maybe it was 80 times, it was just continually the tiniest tweaks, and most every time he tweaked it, I would change the lyrics just that much. And he looked up at me at one point. He said, "You are so patient with me. Carol never would have put up with it." Meaning his wife, Carol Bearsager. So that's what you're
I'm
with.
Out. I'm done. When you started out, I know you were someone, I mean, I remember this from our early days, like just a reader, a voracious reader, and someone who consumed literature, the classics, modern literature. Did you love musicals? I never knew you to be a musical theater.
I wasn't.
Maven. Yeah.
I wasn't. And that's part of what Michael so brilliantly brought to Duncan and me. Is not just that he loved them, but he had such know-how and such expertise and such. He is a musical theater person, and he's other things than that.
Yes.
And he had that in his bones. He loved Pajama Game. You know, I mean, he loved these shows that I didn't even know anything about. And he knew how they work. And we taught each other. You know, we created that together. It was really a threesome. And Tom Hulse was hugely involved.
Totally. So because you met Duncan, it became a musical, right? Rather than a reinvention of Spring Awakening for American audiences in 2000. So that's the kind of... Because maybe had you not met Duncan, you would have continued to write plays. Right? 100%. Who knows?
100%. Yeah. My life turned this mystic corner. I never would have. And I might never have had a career in a certain way. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. For everything you just said, all of which is true, the fact that I work and make a living in the theater to writing musicals. And my career now, all my major projects are musicals.
Yeah.
Or they have musical, they're television shows with musical elements.
But still, even if they're for the screen, it has that. So it turns out you love it. I mean, you're not just good at it, but you enjoy the making of it.
I really do. And there are musicals I really deeply love and appreciate. Though I will confess, I'm still not, it was actually a podcast with the associate music director of the Almeida production of Spring Awakening.
Yeah.
And he started quizzing, we did this great podcast. And then at the end, he started like quizzing Duncan and me, this fun quiz about musical theater history. And it was just like, you are asking the wrong people. We have no idea.
Next, pass. Next. That's like me when we play Heads Up with my kids, and I'm like, I don't, Mariah Carey. They're like, what? No, that's 100 years ago, Mom. Okay, I just wanna, before we fast forward, I wanna understand how it got to the Atlantic, because then it went to Broadway and it hasn't stopped.
That's true. Duncan and I began work on it. I thought we needed a director. We totally did. And I called Michael. He was my first call, and I hadn't spoken to him in several years. And he had become this golden boy of New York theater. And it was mystic, Alana. Here's another amazing little known fact. I called Michael, whom I hadn't spoken to. He picked up. It was a landline. He picked up the phone. He said, I never pick up this phone anymore because Scott Rudin is always calling me. I said, sorry.
That is a sentence that works in so many different ways now. I never pick up this phone because Scott Rudin is calling me.
I remember. And I said, well, I'm so glad I got you. Mm-hmm. I just want to ask you something. I have this idea for a musical, a version of Spring Awakening, and I would be writing the songs with Duncan Sheik. We've begun writing songs together, and there was silence, total silence. And I said, I said, Michael, he said, I can't believe you're saying this to me. I said, why? He said, two nights ago, I was out with my producer of Sideman. And I said to him, things have been going so great for me. I'm being offered so much work, but nothing I can really stick my teeth into. Why doesn't someone offer me Spring Awakening?
Come on.
I swear.
Come on.
I swear.
Incredible.
I swear. And within like 3 days, we were at Michael's house. Well, I came. Duncan was like an hour and a half late. And so we were leaving. And then Duncan showed up.
And that's never happened again since, I'm sure. The only time he was late in all these years. Wow.
Michael took it to Annie Hamburger, who was running the La Jolla Playhouse. She commissioned it. We did a workshop there. Michael took it to mention it to the Roundabout. They agreed to do a workshop of it. I just talked to Todd Hames about this. Huh. I mean, over Zoom, but we just had this long talk about it a week ago. And Todd saw the workshop and fell in love with it. And he said, what do you want? And I said, I want a next workshop and a production. He said, you have it. And I told Michael, he said, you are crazy. He never said that. He would never say that. And he did say that. So we got our next workshop. We were announced. And then we had to postpone because of Thoroughly Modern Millie. And then we were announced for a year later, and we were also announced at the Long Wharf. And then we had to postpone for Thoroughly Modern Millie tour. And then 9/11 had hit, and there were these terrible budget cuts. And there was this season that Roundabout had to cancel like 5 things.
Right.
You're one of them. And we were dead effectively in the water for like 4 years. And we couldn't get it going anywhere. And suddenly the show that everyone who was in the room with wanted to produce, wanted to do the album. It was like a script with German names and a rock CD. And Tom Hulse came on board, and he thought, was confident we would get it going in London. Everyone passed. And we did Lincoln Center. Tom was able to get us a night at Lincoln Center in the what that series is called. It's like this Great American Songbook series. And we did a reading, and we invited a bunch of people, and Ira Pittleman came on board was a financial partner. And then the Atlantic came on board. So that's how we ended up with Atlantic.
What a journey. And then, wow. So that's how that happened.
8 years.
And the cast that many of them were newcomers at the time, and now they are household names. Can you talk a little bit about assembling? Because almost all of the kids went on to the Broadway production from the Atlantic production, as I recall. Yeah. There were some adult shifts in casting. Do you remember being in that room when it was being cast, as each of those now household names came in the room?
I remember every moment of it, to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. I remember it so acutely. And Leah and I just had dinner with Leah also last week, whom I saw in person, shockingly. And we were talking about her audition. She was 14. She had just turned 14, like a month or two before. She was wearing, she told me what it was, whatever it was, like a brown something skirt, Urban Outfitters or something like
that. Right.
She came in, she sang, I Don't Know How to Love Him. And then she did the scene, You Mean If You Beat Me With It? She was 14. And it was just the floor dropped out from under me. It was so astonishing. Jonathan, I remember him coming in and singing. The first thing he did for us was to sing Left Behind. And he had closed his eyes the entire time. And I'm going to tell another tale out of school. he left and we were all so moved. It was like, this is Melchior. And Kim Grigsby said, he cannot sing it. We cannot cast him. And so we kept auditioning. Leah was part of it for 7 years.
So the workshops, the readings, all the different.
Jonathan came in before the final workshop at Baruch and then the Atlantic.
Yeah.
John Gallagher joined at Lincoln Center in 2005. John Gallagher, we were so excited. I was so excited about his audition. He was an off-Broadway actor. He'd never been in a musical. And he just told us this story. And when we were doing the reunion, he came to the callbacks and he was so freaked out by the skills of all these actors in the room. He thought he could never get it. He left, he panicked and left. And he called and his manager, and I remember it. I remember we were all in the room and it was like, where's John Gallagher? And he had left. And then Jim Carnahan like manned up and like got his manager on the phone and got the manager reached John, and John came back. And that was John. Skylar, I had talks with his dad, so did Michael, about him leaving NYU. Skylar had done it as a high school student when he was on Long Island, when we did it at Lincoln Center.
Yes.
And then he was not in the Baruch workshop, and then we lost a cast member, and then we called Skylar. I mean, it was amazing. Lily was one of the last people we cast. She was a replacement. For the Atlantic.
Yeah.
Amazing.
On and on. I want to just talk a little bit before I let you go about this. I mean, there's so much coming up that we're going to hear about after this episode comes out of many, many projects that are in the burner, as we say, that are slowly going to be out in the world and we can go see them. Some Lovers with Burt Bacharach, I can already feel just in our conversation how special it was for you to work with him, what an admirer you are of him as an artist and a human. Can you just, for our audience, list whoever comes to your head, the talent of people who are singing on this record, like off the top of your head, name six of them.
Jonathan and Leah, Kristen Chenoweth, Jennifer Holliday, Ramin Karimloo,
Derek Klena,
Molly Gordon, Derek Klena and Christy Altamari, Ashley Park and Conrad Rickamora. I mean, it's astonishing that we got.
Yeah.
And I felt so, this was a huge pandemic event for me. I felt like a pauper. Like I was going to these people whom I knew and like begging, like, can you come for no money? Can you record it in your closet? I mean, Ethan Slater, whom I had never met, recording this song in his closet on Zoom with Zoom audio breaking down for 2 hours. And he kept repeating, he kept having to sing the first line of the song. And the line was, and so we're just starting out, aren't we? It was like, all I could do was not to laugh in his face. And
did you cast all these songs in your mind? Or did someone like how does this happen?
It was I cast it in my mind. Okay. I mean, it was really calling favors. And then there are people who really wanted to do it and you're desperate for them to do it and you talk about them doing it. I don't know if I should mention my good friend, and it just didn't work out. Mm-hmm. And so then you're like scrambling. I mean, it was crazy getting Ramin recorded on the last possible day, and we wanted to get it out by Grammy deadline. Mm-hmm. And
so that was why there was pressure, because you had a deadline.
Ultimately, yeah, we had a deadline.
Yeah.
And after the 2 years it took to do it, suddenly it was like, we have to get this done now. And there's a musical, there's a show that Bert and I have been developing and that we've worked on and we thought was going into production on like in regional theaters and possibly coming for a limited run on Broadway. And it was like, all that fell apart, of course, like theater fell apart with the pandemic.
Right.
Like, no, we're going to make this album. Bert is 93. We had to bring it out. It was just like, this is time to get this done.
Talk about pressure more than anything.
Yeah,
beyond a Grammy deadline, it's his work needs to be out there.
That's what I really felt. And that this is for him. And that's how I feel the Grammy nomination is. I don't mean to be self-effacing. Of course, I love it. It's beautiful. But for Bert, I feel like it's another honor. in his career.
Also, to be in your 90s and to be prolific and making work, and it, what an inspiration. I mean, how astonishing that that you were able to do this with him. And maybe there are more records in him, or who knows, but there was this one, and it happened, and it happened with you.
Yeah.
And were you kind of set up by a label? Did you have a mutual friend? Of all the people, how did this marriage creatively happen?
It happened because my music publishing deal, I needed to make a new music publishers look after the rights of a songwriter the same way an agent looks after the rights of an actor or writer.
Okay.
So I had no music. My music publishing deal ran out during the zenith of Spring Awakening. So it was like the only time I had good timing in my life. And I was suddenly, as opposed to meeting, you know, begging for a meeting somewhere, I was like in the CEO's offices. And every meeting had this same turn where they would say, so you have this great relationship with Duncan. What composers can we introduce you to? And I would draw a blank. And then they would start talking about the composers who I'm sure are great, who are, you know, were writing songs in American Idol. That was the moment for that. And I said, well, Burt Bacharach. And everyone was like, yeah, Raj, yeah, and who else? And then I was in Warner Chapel, and they said, oh, we've had Burt's guy here for 20 years. And a week later, Burt called me.
And there you go.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to hop around for 1 second before I let you go. I saw Alice by Heart. I loved it so much. And what is really astonishing, there are these group of kids. I don't know what is in the water fountains at Harvard Westlake High School in California. I've had probably all of them on the podcast at this point, between Ben Platt and Catherine Gallagher and Molly Gordon and Beanie Feldstein. I mean, the archive of videos of those school musicals alone, it's just an insane thing that so much talent is in that one high school. But what some people may know and some people may not know is that Molly Gordon, who happens to be Jesse Nelson's daughter, is part of this group of extraordinary young musical theater artists who really are the next generation of musical theater. And I love that Ben Platt had been in these original concerts of that piece, and now he and Noah are a couple, Noah Galvin, who then ended up doing the New York production. It's so inspiring to be around all of them because of how uncynical they are and how passionate they are about musical theater. And so when I think about the directors you're working with, when I think about that crew of young people and beyond who are filling our stages with just really incredible work, it's kind of astonishing.
It is. You know, I saw those musicals at Harvard Westlake with them. And I saw
Did your kids go there also?
No, they didn't.
Okay.
They went to Campbell Hall. But I went to see Molly, and Molly was not at Harvard Westlake. She was at what's that school called? Starts with the C's, the more progressive school, where I saw her in
Crossroads?
Yes, Crossroads.
Yeah.
She did Sunday in the Park with George. She did Chicago with Ben. She did all these shows, but I saw them do Into the Woods. I saw Beanie steal the show, Ben, Catherine, all of them. And they were all our cast in Alice. So we actually have a film of them doing the first readings of Alice. Darren Criss was part of it.
Oh, that's right.
This remarkable team of people, and Molly's was with it all those years.
Yeah. And that was also, I mean, I just think you have such an incredible way of revitalizing and reimagining this thing we think we know. And then you wrote a companion book about Alice in Wonderland. I mean, the way you are examining texts and putting out your spin on all these things, what a canon, Mr. Sater.
Thank you.
Poetry. I mean, it's just cool. So I can ask you for another little known fact. You've already been so generous along the way. If there's anything, I guess maybe I'll ask you to be specific to close out. Is there a little known fact you can share about what at this point in your life is your kind of personal artistic mission because if you felt like doing nothing but reading books on the beach for the rest of your life, we would say, you've given us enough. That's fair. But you seem to still really want to make work and create stuff to put in the world.
Oh, I'm driven. Yeah. I want to, you know, I had this determination for 8 years, the Spring Awakening, to touch the troubled heart of youth around the world. I make determinations and I want, you know, to develop the vitality of my life so I can impart that to my work. My project right now, I have a lot of projects on my plate. I mean, I really have a crazy amount. I could move the suit camera around and you would lose your mind at the piles of projects. But I've determined this New Year's, which I've never done and I've never fully pursued, that I wanted to bring out a book of poems and about the plague. That I've been in this, I mean, I know we're like shifting topics. I could talk about all these musicals and projects I'm working on, but that's a little known fact. I have a novel I've been working on for many years that I've worked on a lot through the pandemic. So I have my private writerly things. Mm-hmm. I sit and read in that room. I mean, I what can I do? I mean, I don't know if these are little known facts, but I've...
Well, they're little known facts that have turned into... life-changing pieces of art for people to go see. So thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, Alana. It's such a joy to me to see you and to have this conversation. And you're so incisive. These questions are so remarkable and the breadth of knowledge you're bringing, even about me, let alone the theater. It's incredible.
Wow. I appreciate that. All right, my friend, we'll get back to work. You've slept long enough. Get back to it. I love you. I will see you soon. Bye.
Bye.
One more thing. So many of you have asked, how do you donate to the podcast? Well, it could not be easier. Just go to littleknownfactspodcast.com/donations. Instructions are clearly laid out, and I'm so grateful to you in advance for any donation you choose to make. But regardless, I have loved, loved, loved making the previous 200 and something episodes for you. I can't wait to make 200 more. I wish you a beautiful day. Stay healthy. Be safe. Until next time. Clouds can make the wind blow. Bugs can make the grass grow. So, there you go. These are little known facts that now you know. This episode of Little Known Facts was edited by Nicholas Klar. We record in New York City. The Little Known Facts theme song was written and recorded and sung by Georgia Famusa with backup vocals by Caleb Famusa. Thank you.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.